The matter of Harold Hanson versus Rite Aid Corporation et al. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning. Denise Campbell from Campbell Legal Associates representing the plaintiff appellant.
John Green of Green Savitz representing Amicus Neal in New Jersey.
Good morning. Molly Lindhorst from American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, friend of the court.
Good morning. Peter Burke from Genova Burns.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Campbell, please go ahead. Justice Solomon will be participating. He's watching the argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are two questions before this court. The first question is whether the appellate division committed reversible error by affirming a decision of the lower court that was based on inappropriate factors, unpublished decisions, and personal opinion of the trial judge based on Her Honor's professional experience, all of which has been prohibited by this court, and in particular, the Rendine case, which was decided approximately 27 years ago. There's no question that the appellate division committed reversible error by affirming the lower court's decision. The second question is whether the appellate division committed reversible error by applying the 10-day time limit imposed by Rule 2:11-4 to override the prevailing party threshold requirement of the New Jersey Law Against Discrimination and its fee-shifting provision. By doing so, the court determined that the plaintiff waived his right to fee shifting, to the fee shifting provision, and to the reimbursement of legal fees on appeals before he became a prevailing party. And as we know from the law against discrimination, a plaintiff is not entitled to fees until he becomes a prevailing party. I'd like to address the first question initially regarding whether the appellate division ignored 25 years of Supreme Court precedent in affirming the lower court's decision. In Rendine and its progeny, there's no question that the framework and the guidelines were set forth as to how the courts should proceed in deciding fee applications in remedial statutes. The first determination that should be made is the lodestar, which is the reasonable number of hours expended by the reasonable hourly rate. And the framework decided by this court set forth several criteria. The first criteria to be considered is the interest to be vindicated, the damages recovered, and it does not require proportionality. That too has been addressed by this court. The underlying statutory objectives and the attorney's experience and skill as compared to other attorneys with similar experience and skill in the community. The framework also includes that hours can be deducted if work is non-productive, and this court gave an example of three attorneys appearing at a hearing when one would suffice. Another reason hours may be deducted is if they are excessive. And whether they are excessive depends on whether they're consistent with what competent counsel reasonably would have spent to achieve a comparable result. Unsuccessful claims. Billing regarding unsuccessful claims can also be deducted if those claims are distinct in all ways from the successful claims. Once the lodestar is determined, the court must decide whether to award an enhancement of that fee. And this court has said in Rendine that the fee award can't be reasonable unless it's adjusted to reflect the risk of non-payment. And in this case, there's a risk of non-payment for a few reasons. First, this case was taken on a pure contingency basis. Another factor that increased the risk is that the defendant is a distressed company who for years has been on the brink of bankruptcy. So every time we tried this case, the ante went up. There was more time invested, more money invested, and more chance that we would never see a dime if Rite Aid filed for bankruptcy. Another reason, another level of risk is that as the further you get from the date of termination, the more likely you are to lose witnesses. We lost witnesses over the course of this case. There were several witnesses who could not or would not appear at the third trial.
Would you like some water?
No, I'm fine. Thank you, Judge. In this case, the appellate division affirmed the lower court's decision on the hourly rate and the number of hours billed, as well as the expert charges based on her personal, her honor's personal opinion, based on her professional experience, and this is unequivocally prohibited by this court in Rendine, Walker, and the July 2020 decision by the appellate division in Siegelstein. Lower court reduced the rate by almost half, reduced the expert, the medical expert's rate by almost half. And those decisions were made, the court admitted, based on a general awareness of what attorneys in Monmouth County charge and what experts in Monmouth County charge. And admittedly, based on her own, her personal opinion, based on her professional experience.
I think that maybe a bit of an exaggeration. Didn't the court find that the hourly rate was not established sufficiently based upon the local customary rates for attorneys of similar skill and experience? That was missing from the proofs here?
Well, the decision specifically says that the reduction in the rate was based on what the trial court judge knows to be the rates in Monmouth County, based on her honors sitting in.
As I read Judge Grosso Jones's decision, she finds a deficiency in your proofs, your client's proofs, based upon what was not, in her view, presented.
That was mentioned also.
Right, and that really is the core of her decision. And then she goes on to come up with a number. And some of the factors that you mentioned were involved there. But to say that this was sort of out of whole cloth personal opinion, it seems to me that she was looking at the burden on you to, and your client to present adequate proofs of the local rate for attorneys of similar skill and experience, and didn't see that.
Well, we did submit that in the form of my certification, the certification of two unaffiliated attorneys, a New Jersey survey of attorneys, and two other retainer agreements that were agreed to with my firm, where the rate was slightly lower, but on exponentially better terms. And in fact, the defendants did not submit a certification from the lead attorney. They did not submit certifications from unaffiliated attorneys. They simply submitted their opinion that the rate should be lower, and they submitted an unpublished order out of Ocean County Superior Court, where an attorney was asked for and was given the rate of $375 an hour. However, that case is not comparable for many reasons. That attorney has 15 years less experience than I have. That case was tried once. The duration of that case was 3 years. The plaintiff put in his case in 2 days. The trial lasted 6 days. That's not comparable at all.
There's a technical issue about certifications versus statements, correct? The two attorney certifications? Statements were not certifications.
Well, they were certifications, Your Honor. They were duly sworn certifications.
Didn't the trial judge find that the language contained in those statements did not qualify as certifications under
that,
the rules?
That was the trial judge's opinion, yes. And there have been many cases decided by the appellate division and this court where the attorneys submitted no certifications of unaffiliated attorneys. So that should not be dispositive.
Are you suggesting that when there's a genuine dispute about an attorney's hourly rate in a fee contest, that there ought to be an evidentiary hearing to ascertain what the customary rates are in that region?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that there should be a hearing. I'm suggesting, as this court did in Rendine, Walker, and the appellate division did in Siegelstein, that the motion should be decided based on the preponderance of evidence presented by the attorneys.
But suppose you submitted papers that said your rate is $725 an hour, and other attorneys say that is appropriate or reasonable. And let's assume you had an opposing affidavit from Mr. Burke that said, you know, from another attorney saying, no, it's the customary rate in Monmouth County is much less. How does a judge decide that dispute without an evidentiary hearing?
Well, Your Honor, those were not the facts of this case.
No, I know. So, I'm sure the court's going to decide this case with more than just this case in mind. In a case like that, how is that question decided by a trial judge?
Just so that I understand your question correctly,
Let me put it again. If there are competing affidavits, okay, as to what the customary rate is for someone of your experience in the Central Jersey area, what does a trial judge do other than conduct an evidentiary hearing?
I don't know. I don't think it would be terrible to conduct an evidentiary hearing, but I don't think that's necessary. I've never heard of that happening, and these motions are decided quite often. There's always going to be competing affidavits and certifications. That's how this works.
But isn't that how trial courts deal with disputed facts? They have hearings and listen to testimony. Well, why shouldn't that be done here?
Well, there's no rule that requires that. I guess the judge could have called for that if Her Honor thought that was necessary, but that's not how it was done here, and I don't know that that's a bad idea, but...
Well, you have problems with how it was done here. I'm wondering what your suggestion is as to what a trial judge ought to do in these circumstances.
Well, again, my suggestion is, based on the framework set forth by this court 27 years ago, that the judge should consider the evidence presented by both parties and should absolutely be precluded from offering their own personal opinion based on their professional experience. There's no question that that is reversible error and that that is what was done here. And again, on that point, the court rejected the plaintiff's submissions. And that was something that the appellate division discussed in Siegelstein, that the courts can't do that. They can't reject what the parties submit and substitute their own opinion.
Well, your adversary says Siegelstein was a much better set of proofs than this case because the plaintiff presented proof in the form of certifications that their standard hourly rates had been approved in multiple state and federal cases, and also three qualified certifications by unaffiliated attorneys that don't have the defects that they say existed in your proofs. Mm-hmm. So they would say Siegelstein is a whole different case.
The Siegelstein decision is barely distinguishable from the decision of the lower court in this case. And a different panel at the appellate division reversed it for two reasons. It relied on unpublished opinions, and the trial court relied on Her Honor's own personal opinion based on professional experience. Those are the two factors on which it was reversed, relying on Rendine, Sapansky, Walker, and a number of other cases. In this decision, it's the same thing. The rate was reduced based on an unpublished opinion that in no way resembles this case, and that in which the other attorney has 15 years less experience than I have, was trying his first case, and had a very experienced attorney in Bruce McMorrin sitting second chair. That's not this case.
What was the rate also reduced because the judge found flaws in the submissions the court received?
I don't believe that's what the reason was. The reason was that the judge relied on what Her Honor knows to be, in general, the rates in Monmouth County, having sat in family court and civil court.
Was it wrong for the judge to discount an article about big law hourly rates in New York City?
No, I don't think that was wrong. But that was not the basis of the decision. The basis of the lower court's decision was reliance on the Locke case, which is very clear in the written decision. I think the trial judge...
The big law article was discounted. It was one of, I guess, three respects, I could be wrong on that number, in which the court found your proofs to be deficient. So it obviously is part of the exercise here in these cases for the court to decide, are there sufficient proofs on which that have been presented by the plaintiff, and then if so, to turn to the defendant for countervailing arguments. But the process the court went through here in terms of finding deficiencies, including the reliance on the two articles, that's a pretty typical process in these cases, isn't it?
A pretty typical process
for a trial court to say, I critically look at the plaintiff's proof, hourly rates, and to say, I either accept them or I don't accept them, and here's why.
Yes, and in many of the cases, the judges then relied on their personal opinion based on professional experience and unpublished decisions, exactly what the trial judge did in this case. And that has been held to be reversible error by this court.
That's to get to the number. The court really, as I read it, you tell me if I'm wrong, as I read what went on here, the court really did two things. One, to find your proofs in some respects deficient for the court to establish the numbers here for in terms of the hourly rates, and then went on to set some hourly rates. But in terms of that first component of the court's decision in looking critically at your proofs and finding them to be in certain respects deficient, was there something wrong with what the trial court did?
What was wrong that the trial court did was to rely on unpublished opinions in Locke and Her Honor's own personal experience, having sat in family court and in the law division, and relying on that experience based on having decided these motions before. And that is strictly prohibited and constitutes reversible error, as stated by this court over the last 25 plus years.
So your answer is focusing on the second step in the process.
The ultimate basis for the decision, yes, Your Honor.
Are you taking issue with the judge's determinations with respect to the first set of questions?
Yes. Because I did submit sufficient proofs. I outlined my history. I have 30 years of experience. I've been trying cases since 1995. I do several different types of work. I've had a lot of success. And certainly this case, this very complicated case and protracted case, we were able to achieve a very good result for the client. So I do take exception to the trial judge making a blanket statement that my proofs were deficient.
It's a bit more than a blanket statement. I mean, we have a 54-page chart that goes line by line through certain items, you know, focusing on the hours as well as the rate. The judge spent a lot of time on this. You may not agree with the outcome, but
right. And in Siegelstein, relying on Rendine and Walker, the appellate division addressed that and said, despite the exhaustive review, that does not override the fact that the decision was made based on unpublished opinions and personal opinion based on professional experience.
But that don't, that, well, not to beat a dead horse, but that only goes to the issue of what numbers the court came up with.
As far as the fee?
As far as the
hourly rate?
Right. When the court found your proofs deficient, it was a very precise, as the chief noted, determination, which was reflected a lot of attention to detail. Would you agree with that?
A lot of attention to detail with respect to why the court found my proofs deficient?
Yes.
I don't know that I would agree with that, Your Honor. I don't think I would agree with that. And I say that because, as I quoted in my brief, there are multiple paragraphs by the judge saying things like, the court is familiar with the work of a defense attorney. I used to do defense work 15 years ago, and in my list of clients, I listed companies that I had worked for, insurance companies that I had done work for. The judge said, the court is familiar with the work of a defense attorney in a litigation matter, and specifically the amount that insurance companies and corporations are willing to pay for the same, and it is not at the rate of $7.25 per hour. The court is aware of general counsel fees charged and paid by attorneys in Monmouth County. Well, first of all, a blanket statement about what insurance companies and other independent companies pay, that's just inaccurate. This portion of the opinion by the judge is just simply inaccurate. It's inappropriate to make generalizations like that without some form of proof. The defendants could have submitted affidavits or certifications of other unaffiliated attorneys, but they chose not to do that. The lead counsel did not submit a certification or affidavit regarding what his fee is. Again, the court notes in the decision that family law is a different area of law and the rates charged are different, slightly higher than the rates charged by civil practice and particularly employment law. Again, a gross overgeneralization that is just unacceptable based on the last 25 years of case law coming out of this court.
Ms. Campbell?
Yes.
What should the court have done? Assume for a second that the court's findings, that the burden had not been met, that there were deficiencies, is off the table. The court gives multiple reasons for that. Duplicate entries, more than 24 hours a day, the big law article, and so on. What should the court have done at that point, having rejected submissions of counsel?
Well, I think that's something that I would like for this court to address as part of its decision here. What is the court supposed to do? I mean, this court has blanketly rejected the two factors that this case was ultimately decided on, unpublished opinions, unpublished decisions, and personal opinions.
I understand your point about that. Can you help us and tell us what you believe the court should have done at that point?
Well, I think then the burden should shift to the defendants to establish why that rate that the plaintiff, the prevailing party, is asking for is not reasonable.
If the court has rejected it, the burden should then shift to the opposite party?
No, I think the court has to look at it on the whole. Look at all of the factors together. Look at the case. You can't just make a general statement that nobody pays this rate.
I had the same question.
No,
Are the only data points then published opinions, of which there are very few and which get dated pretty quickly, as one data point, and what the certifications or affidavits say. That's it. That's because it doesn't leave the judge much information to sort this out, does it?
No.
So coming back to the chief's point, how does the court proceed if it's not, on the face of it, persuaded by the submission, yet it wants to be fair and reasonable in calibrating that? You can't look to unpublished opinions, you say. There's, in this case, no affidavit from the other side's attorney. How could the court proceed sensibly in being fair and being reasonable about what compensation is appropriate?
Well, that's a tough question, and that gets back to why we're here, why I'm here. Because, in my opinion, the certifications were complete and satisfactory and not deficient. And if the court found that they were, you know, you have to go to the next step, which is, again, well, what did the defendants submit?
If it's your burden and the court finds, and I'm not suggesting the court was correct or not correct, but the court finds that you have failed to make that burden based upon the criteria the court mentioned, you've not satisfied your burden, then why would the court then say it's now the plaintiff has failed in the burden, so now we're going to put the onus on the defendant to prove the prevailing rights here?
Well, maybe putting the burden on them wasn't the word I should have used. But again, looking at it as a whole, let's see what the defendants say. They've submitted virtually nothing to refute it. And I submitted not only my certification, the other, the two unaffiliated certifications, I think it was the National Law Association's 2018 law firm survey, which my rates were in the range for someone with my experience and expertise in this type of matter.
In addition to finding the statements submitted by the other attorneys deficient, didn't the trial court also find that you, with regard to your experience, that you didn't provide specifics with regard to whether you had ever represented a plaintiff or defendant in an employment discrimination case specifically, aside from this particular client?
It
wasn't just this certification issue and the trial court found that there wasn't any information that you provided to establish your expertise specifically in these discrimination cases.
Well, I didn't provide specific cases because most of the plaintiffs, but I did provide my experience, and I have been doing discrimination cases for 15, 20 years. And I did provide that information. I didn't provide specific cases because none of the cases are anything that anybody would recognize. Many of them were settled before trial or pre-suit with a confidentiality agreement. And many of the people that I represent, the settlements were not large because I represent a lot of people who, say, for example, a college student who working towards a degree in accounting and is harassed at her job as a bookkeeper with a local company. I have represented another woman who was a single mother and worked for a minimum wage at a local liquor store. So I was able to settle these cases. They're not impressive numbers, but these are the types of cases
It seems before the trial court, the evidence that you presented was insufficient for the trial court to have an understanding of the scope of your representation. And in the opinion, the trial judge notes there's general assertions that you handled employment matters for companies, not necessarily individual clients. So I just want to see if you understand and agree that, as far as the trial court's opinion is concerned, there's more than just the certifications being deficient and not accepting the law, you know, the article. There's also the finding that the proofs that you presented with regard to your own experience were not sufficient at that time.
Well, I would disagree with that. And again, in this case alone, it's 14 years already. It's 14 years, 4 months, and a week since my client was fired. It's been next month, it'll be 14 years since the complaint was filed.
But what does that go to?
Well, that goes towards my experience in handling these types of cases. That's one of the experiences that the judge had a front row seat to.
So she was supposed to just say, oh, I've seen this case develop over many years, so that counts as your experience.
No.
Is there anything wrong with a judge requiring precision in an application for a lot of money in which there is a claim of having a certain level of expertise and experience?
And I would argue that I submitted that. That's not the judge's opinion.
My question is not whether you made it clear you feel that the judge was wrong in finding deficiencies. Is there anything wrong with the judge requiring precision in that type of presentation?
No, I don't see anything wrong with that. But again, getting back to the ultimate decision was made on two factors that have been prohibited by this court. And again, going back to Siegelstein, that decision and the decision by the lower court in this case are barely distinguishable. And yet the appellate division reversed that case and reversed that decision in Siegelstein and affirmed the decision in this case.
Ms. Camp, help us understand the relief you seek and what you envision going forward. The trial court, you asked for a certain amount of money. The trial court reduced that amount substantially. The appellate division affirmed. You want us to reverse. And what additional relief are you seeking?
Your Honor, I would like for this court to not reconstitute Rendine, but reaffirm the framework and the guidelines, because it's clear from not only this case, but the Siegelstein case and another case that came up during oral argument of the fee, which is the Hagel case, also all three Monmouth County cases, that decisions are being made based on criteria that this court has prohibited.
And with what that clear statement, then what? What are you seeking? What should happen in this case next?
In this case, I would like this court to reverse the appellate division, to assume original jurisdiction, and to set forth more specific guidelines and criteria on what judges can consider, what they can't consider, what attorneys must submit. I mean, there are plenty of cases where attorneys didn't submit any certifications.
And when you say exercise original jurisdiction, are you asking for this court to award the fee application that you requested?
Either to award it or to send it to a special master. I'm not asking that this court refer the case back to Monmouth County for review.
That's a very unusual remedy.
I understand
any precedent, Rendine included, for anything like that in all of our LAD cases.
I understand. It's very rare.
It's
and it's a big
unprecedented.
Ask. But there are, I believe this court took original jurisdiction in Rendine. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize, but I believe that was the case. But it's clear that the framework set forth by Rendine is not being followed. And it's unclear what constitutes a required submit. What does the attorney have to submit? Because everybody can get certifications from other attorneys saying, yes, this is a reasonable rate. The defense, they could have gotten certifications that say it's not reasonable. They didn't do that.
Do you understand the reason why there's a lot of deference to a trial court who lived through the case, who understands the level of effort involved, who understands the way the case was presented, when the trial court makes these determinations?
Mm-hmm. I do understand.
Do you agree
that
it's appropriate to be very deferential to those determinations?
I don't agree that it's to be very deferential to those opinions because, and I'll give Your Honor an example. In the 2018 Appellate Division decision, that court determined that the trial court improperly conducted a weighing of the evidence, which triggered a sua sponte mistrial after the verdict prior to the punitive damages trial. And in the next paragraph, the court then said, we're going to rely on the trial judge's feel for the case. Those two things are, that's a huge conflict. On one hand, they're saying the trial judge substituted Her Honor's own opinion for that of the jury. And then in the second instance, they're saying, but we'll trust her feel for the case. The judge had the wrong feel for the case. I mean, this, the tortured history of this case is unprecedented. And I don't believe that the court should give unlimited deference to a trial judge when the decision is wrong. It should not be rubber stamped.
Ms. Campbell, is there anything you'd like to add?
I'd like to discuss the Rule 211-4, if Your Honor would allow.
Please go ahead.
I'm asking this court to consider that in conjunction with the LAD and its fee-shifting provision. Because as they exist now, and as the based on the analysis of the trial court and the appellate division, plaintiffs who are victims of discrimination who have to go to the appellate division to get a new trial, like I had to do twice, and then they win the appeal, but they're not yet prevailing parties entitled to fees. The way the lower court's decision reads is that the plaintiff should have filed a motion for fees in the appellate division pursuant to the 2:11-4 when the plaintiff was not entitled to fees and may never have been entitled to fees.
Is your point that the rule should be amended? To provide for the motion when the party is a prevailing party.
Yes, because that is consistent with the LAD. The LAD requires that threshold requirement of a prevailing, that the plaintiff become a prevailing party before they are entitled to fees. So in this case, I would have had to file several motions for fees. They 100% would have been denied. Defendant's first line in their opposition, I'm sure, would have been, plaintiff's not entitled to fees, they're not a prevailing party. And that's a waste of time and money and the court's resources. And even in cases where the plaintiff is a prevailing party, but the case on any one claim, but the case is sent back to the trial court for further trial on other issues, the appellate division doesn't decide the fees. They say, go back and put your fees in the if you eventually win on the other claim, so that it's all one motion.
Can interim success as a plaintiff ever justify a partial fee award? Example, not this case. The defense files a non-meritorious motion for leave to appeal. Okay. You spend many hours writing a brief in opposition, and the appellate division either grants leave and summarily affirms the trial judge, vindicating your position, or denies leave. Under the LAD, would you ever be, or a person in that situation, be entitled to an interim fee in staving off what turned out to be an unmeritorious effort to get the case out of the trial court?
No, Your Honor, because there's no provision for that in the LAD. Okay. It requires a threshold requirement of prevailing party. And I can give Your Honor an example of something that happened in this case. In 2012, I filed a motion for leave to appeal Judge Quinn's decision preventing me from obtaining out-of-state depositions regarding prior discrimination by the aider and abettor, Mr. Moriello. The appellate division denied my motion for leave to appeal. So we tried the case. 4 years later, we get the verdict is, this is the first trial. The verdict is thrown out on judgment notwithstanding the verdict. I go back to the appellate division, and they give me a new trial by reversing that order that they declined to hear. Now, in the big scheme of things, my client should get reimbursement for the fees on that motion for leave to appeal because it should have been granted. We wasted 4 years and an entire trial because the appellate division declined to hear the motion for leave to appeal.
That's the point of my question. Even if your client didn't prevail at the very end of the case on the ultimate issues, is there no authority under the LAD implied or otherwise for interim success?
No, there is not.
Okay.
I think we have your position on the rule.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Green.
May it please the court, I know I raised a host of issues in my amicus brief, and 5 minutes won't cover it. I'm not sure if the court has any questions. There is one particular issue that animates me on behalf of Nila, NJ, and all plaintiffs' attorneys. That is the whole concept of limited success. What is limited success? And I think in this particular case, it's an example of what is not, quote, limited success. The plaintiff here was fired ostensibly for being a thief. It took 14 years to clear his name and prove that he was fired because he was gay. And the jury in the third trial found punitive damages, saying that by clear and convincing evidence that the employer acted maliciously, to say that that is limited success boggles, in my mind, the imagination. Now, the problem is this, and I was reading the briefs last night, there's a ton of cases coming down from Rendine, and by the way, I was on the Rendine case, I was one of the plaintiff's attorneys, so I'm familiar with it, where the whole concept of a fee award should be reduced for limited success. The problem is it's a very subjective concept. How do you measure limited success? And I wrote in my amicus brief a case that my firm and I in particular handled that actually got a lesser result financially than what Ms. Campbell got in her case. And yet the special master in that case, former Chief Justice Cezalli, did not find limited success at all, but awarded basically full amount of fees and a 35% multiplier to my firm for trying the case and 40% for the attorney who handled all the pretrial proceedings for over 10, 11 years up to the point of trial. I believe that the concept of limited success should be eliminated. Now, I am cognizant, I was racking my brains about this for the last couple of weeks. Well, how does the court make sure that the plaintiff's attorney or the attorney who prevails in the fee-shifting context doesn't over-litigate the case? And I think the answer is this. Does the work that the attorney performed that obtained the success materially contribute to that success? So, for example, if you have a case that goes on for a number of years, and for some reason the plaintiff was able to take 30 depositions, but yet it's only a 3-day trial, that would sort of, you know, at first blush, seem to think that the plaintiff attorney did over-litigate the case. I like to point out, though, that an attorney, let's say, especially plaintiff's attorneys handling employment cases, especially where there's specific intent, you have to prove intent, a illegal motive. Plaintiff's attorneys are like detectives. They're looking for evidence to prove illegal motive. So how do they go about doing that? They do it through written discovery requests, finding out who were the decision makers, and then they start to, and then they take depositions. And it could very well be depositions of witnesses 1, 2, and 3 come up with no evidence whatsoever, but instead may give leads and give leads to the to another set of witnesses. And the point is this: did the depositions, did the written discovery, did the motion practice materially contribute to the success of the case? And I think that's the way it should be analyzed.
That's a very low bar. Because you could then say, I took 30 depositions, and over here I found out an address, and over here I found out a name, because seldom are depositions taken that produce nothing. So what you're telling us here is that we should replace the concept that's been in Rendine for all these years of limited success with, doesn't matter what they did, as long as there's something came out of each of those 30 depositions that materially contributed to the wealth of knowledge that the plaintiff's lawyer has. That's very low bar, I would suggest.
Well, first of all, I would suggest this to Your Honor. I know I would not take 30 depositions in the case.
No, I understand.
Yeah. And I'm just using an extreme example.
Right, but that's the sort of hypothetical. It could be 10 depositions. It could be in some cases 5. But that's the sort of example that you're saying that the analysis that's in Rendine is not fair to plaintiffs, and there should be a different test. And that, I just respectfully, it sounds to me that the test you're proposing, which is there something here that contributed to the entire amount of the case, essentially. I can't think of a deposition in my experience that didn't produce something. That's basically saying, okay, we're going to throw out the limited success standard and say if they got anything out of it, they're good.
I think that's an extreme interpretation. Here's why. Let's assume you have several different claims, and you're deposing witnesses on these several different claims, and the claim, let's assume 4 different claims, 3 fall by the wayside, no cost or dismissed on summary judgment, and 1 claim succeeds. Then it would be incumbent upon the plaintiff's counsel, like myself, to actually eliminate or delete that time. So, and I would suspect, Your Honor, that it's very rare that when you have 1 claim, let's say like a LAD claim, if that's the only claim that the petitioner had pled in this case, that you're going to have a situation where you're going to have that many depositions.
The hypothetical you give about the different claims is one in which you can parse out that the discovery is only relevant to one claim or another. That's just not always the case, and you may have discovery that relates to a number of different claims, some that succeed and some that fail. It seems to me that what the court in Rendine was trying to get at is a workable standard that the trial judge who knows the case can sort out what should be compensable and what should not be. And I, respectfully and with great respect to you, Mr. Green, the standard you're providing just seems to me to be not very meaningful.
The problem, Your Honor, is this, and as I pointed out in my brief, limited success is a very subjective standard, and it's all over the lot. The case that our own firm's case, the Montone case, if you had flipped the judges, if you had said Justices Alley should be the special master on Ms. Campbell's case, and had Judge Grasso Jones look at the Montone case, I think you would get materially different results.
Obviously, we don't know anything about that case, and you know, it's sort of, you know, you're telling us about a case that's not, I presume, is unpublished and is special.
Well, it was attached. The decision was attached to the certification as part of the motion for amicus.
Right, but I mean, hard for us to really
The other thing is, and I noticed that you mentioned deference for the trial judge. You know, in the law division, the trial judge is not the judge who's overseeing the discovery in the case. So therefore, the trial judge only sees the finished product. As opposed to federal court.
That's not always the case. You can have judges handle discovery, but the trial judge is there for the trial.
I understand that, but unless it's explained explicitly as to what process had to be gone, and obviously the plaintiff's attorney should delineate that in their certifications when they file their petition, they have to indicate what they had to go through to get the specific evidence to put into evidence, so they come to a specific, they come to a to a successful result. I respectfully, Justice Patterson, disagree with you that the material contribution to success is that low of a bar. I can tell you that in the Montone case, we had a sexual harassment claim in there, which is noted in the decision by Justice Azali, which is attached. There was no cause, and we had to delete time for that. I think that, attorneys that have distinct claims that don't contribute to the successful claims must delete the time. And I therefore, if the plaintiff's attorney or the prevailing attorney cannot show that whatever work that they did, for example, in the Montone case, we had in limine motions that we lost, or we had claims that were rejected, where the in limine motions where we succeeded were for naught. They should be deleted. It didn't materially contribute to the success of the ultimate outcome. And I respectfully disagree that that is a low bar.
We have your suggestion with respect to limited success. I wanted to ask you about something else. As amicus who heard the prior argument, can you help us on the question of what should happen if we reach a point in the analysis where a trial judge has reviewed the submissions of counsel, finds them deficient, finds the burden hasn't been met? What should take place next?
I reviewed the certifications by not only Ms. Campbell, but also by the supporting certifications. And what struck me, and the reason why Neela did not take a position on her hourly rate, is because those certifications, the people who submitted them, did not indicate what experience they had in employment law.
And I'm not asking you to opine on this case.
No, I understand that. So So the question is, what information should be provided? Then I thought of another scenario, which may seem a little off base, but bear with me. What happens if Clarence Darrow tried this case in the prime, and he was considered one of the great trial lawyers in American history and had no employment law experience? He's practicing 30, that's right after the Sacco and Vanzetti, result where he got his people off from the death penalty. He's considered one of the best trial lawyers in the country, but has no employment law experience. What kind of hourly rate should he be given? Should he have tried this case?
I think it was probably
successful?
$2 an hour back then.
In $22. How do you evaluate that? I don't know the answer to that. I know for a fact, I know what the market hourly rate is in my field because of the affidavits that were put in are usually from attorneys from my field on the plaintiff's side. And by the way, the plaintiff's side of their hourly rates are going to be different from the defense side for a lot of reasons. First of all, defense attorneys may, especially if they work for insurance companies, are going to charge less hourly rates, but they know they're going to get paid, as opposed to hourly rates on behalf of plaintiff's attorneys, where they're, if it's a contingency situation, they're going to be taking the risk.
I don't mean to catch you on one foot, but what guidance would you give?
Excuse me?
What guidance would you give under the scenario we're talking about?
With regard to this specific case?
This kind of a case. Judge has the submissions and rejects them for one reason or another, and assume that the rejections are based in law.
You should write your decision indicating the criteria that a prevailing counsel must submit in their certification. And I would say remand back to the law division, to a different judge.
I think you're misunderstanding the chief's question.
We're in the trial court.
Oh, you're in the trial court.
Judge says you haven't carried your burden of proof and gives an explanation that what's not, assume it has nothing to do with some of the issues that have been raised here, personal yeah. experience and the like. What happens next?
I don't remember if it was done in this case, but I would tell the counsel, I need to see X, Y, and Z. So I want you to submit supplemental papers. Otherwise, I'm gonna set the rate.
Okay.
And also, I would say this, and I'll probably be unpopular for saying this amongst my fellow plaintiff's attorneys. I actually think unpublished decisions, let's say within the last 5 years, of the date of the petition being filed, even though they're not precedential under 136-3, where they indicate hourly rates for plaintiff's attorneys, in that particular field where there's a fee-shifting situation, may be useful, obviously not binding, but may be useful in terms of determining what the market rate is.
Do you agree with the trial judge that there's a distinction between using an unpublished decision as precedent, which is barred by the court rule 136, and using, as you say, a recent unpublished decision which states a rate?
If the rate is supported by certifications by other counsel with the criteria of X, Y, and Z, as I suggested, in other words, there's sufficient criteria or indicia in the supporting certifications in that particular case, and if the attorney who's seeking the award of hourly fees, let's say, has a comparable amount of experience to the plaintiff's counsel, yes, I think that could be used as a guide. It's not necessarily dispositive.
If the court now, and you've suggested the court should give essentially a do-over to the plaintiff, what you're showing is deficient. You have to do other things. Let me tell you what they are. But if the trial court is within its discretion in saying you had your chance, and I don't see the showing, but I have to deal with this fee application, can the court, without the plaintiff saying the court should look at these decisions, can the court refer to rates in unpublished, stated in an unpublished decision?
I know that Walker versus Geoffrey says no. So does Siegelstein. But as I guess Justice Sabatino, was referred to you as Justice Sabatino? Yeah.
Judge,
okay.
Please.
Okay, Judge Sabatino points out there is a dearth of published decisions on hourly rates, especially within the last 5 years, and especially given the inflation rate. And obviously, you got to look at the consumer price index in terms of if an hourly rate is given, let's say, someone of comparable experience to Ms. Campbell, let's say 5 years ago, well, inflation has really ratcheted that up. So I think that's a factor that has to be looked into also.
Now, Mr. Green, doesn't that open up a can of worms that, for example, in He versus Miller, in terms of remitter, there was a period of time when trial judges would get, supplied with unpublished decisions about verdict levels and then have to tease out, is this case different than the one before me or a lot like it? And ended up having a very burdensome and confounding situation, which eventually this court ended. Isn't this any reliance on unpublished opinions similarly going to be that kind of a difficult exercise?
If I remember correctly, I think He versus Miller is an emotional distress award. Am I correct?
Yeah. And pain and suffering, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think that's different because injuries are different, emotional distresses are different. There's a lot more nuance in that situation. it's almost like, you know, I likened it. I remember we had this argument amongst ourselves in my amicus committee where, well, how do you determine the price of a house? What's the market value of a house? So you look at comps. So the same thing, I think I understand your concern, and I'm not exactly thrilled with this either, but the whole purpose of Rendine is to set a market rate. And how do you set a market rate? Well, certainly if a attorney has been adjudicated to be, let's say, X amount of dollars per hour, let's say within the last couple of years, based on evidence that's been submitted not only by themselves, but also by supporting certifications, that in a sense, it's almost like a judicial appraisal of the market rate.
What's wrong with, as a path of least resistance, rather than going through whether unpublished opinions ought to be considered or not, that in many cases, particularly a case like this where you have a $5 million counsel fee request, why can't or would you favor, in your experience, a judge appointing her own expert to say, I need an independent opinion as to what a fair hourly rate is for an attorney handling a LAD case like this in Monmouth County?
Like a special master?
Would that have not have been a simpler solution than what we're doing now? Or?
Like a special master?
No, an expert to testify as to what the rates are around the state and what they ought to be in Central Jersey.
Well, how do you define an expert? I mean,
a lawyer? Who practices in the field?
I mean, yeah, I guess. The problem is, do you do a defense attorney, a management attorney who has their biases, or do you have a plaintiff's attorney who has their biases? I think that probably a retired judge may be the best way to go about doing it, and then they submit evidence, you know, both sides submit evidence. I understand the quandary you're in here. I do get it. At the same time, I'm concerned that, you know, Ms. Campbell did put in 14 years of her life into this with three trials. And I found it disconcerting, to say the least, that only a 20% multiplier was given when she had to try a case three times and take two appeals.
I'm going to ask you to try to curtail the rest of your argument.
Yeah, okay, sure.
We went a little beyond 5 minutes, as you had hoped.
We certainly did. I don't know if I gave you a good answer. You know, we found in our Montone case, Justice Sally be very fair. And he was appointed a special master, and of course, he was paid for his time. I think that was the fairest way to go in our situation. And at the same time, you know, the hourly rate that was given to Ms. Campbell was based not only on an unpublished decision, but not a fair comparison.
I think we have okay. Your argument.
The rest of the issues are pretty much laid out in my brief, and you know, you can do it. Hopefully, you'll accept them.
Thank you, Ms. Lindhorst.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. New Jersey's law against discrimination is intended to open the courthouse doors wider, to ensure there's greater access to counsel who are competent to take on these cases, particularly on contingency, and that people will be able to access the courts with this counsel. And fee shifting is a crucial part of legislation like the Law Against Discrimination and the New Jersey Civil Rights Act. It's crucial to also know how attorneys' fees are calculated so that attorneys are more willing to take on these cases. ACLU of New Jersey's brief focuses on three particular elements that we saw in the lower court's opinions here that could have unintended consequences in terms of access to counsel and access to the courts. The first being the role of prior or standard billing rates in setting the hourly rate for the Lodestar. The second being what the contours of the relevant community is also for determining the hourly rate. And finally, the length of time and corresponding increased risk of nonpayment and how that plays into the proper enhancement. I'd like to take each of these independently. First, the role of a standard or prior billing rate by an attorney. Now, to be clear, we are not saying that it should not be a factor. However, we encourage the court to take a more expansive view and to not allow prior or standard billing rates to dictate the hourly rate that is granted in fee shifting cases. And this is for an obvious reason, that it could disadvantage certain attorneys and disincentivize certain attorneys from taking on these cases, particularly when they're considering taking them on contingency. Our public interest attorneys and nonprofit attorneys working in New Jersey are filling really important needs for the community, and they shouldn't be penalized for taking on these roles in perhaps a less lucrative organization, or for the expertise that they provide in these sorts of cases. My colleague, for example, Alex Shalom, has never billed a client in 18 years, but attorneys who are otherwise not regularly billing clients should not be subjected to lower rates or expected to be limited to low bono rates that they might otherwise charge. Consequently, we urge the court to make very clear in any decision that prior or standard billing does not dictate what should be granted in fee shifting cases. Second, we encourage the court to make clear and expand the understanding of what the relevant community is for setting hourly fees. Now, we all know that a lot has changed in the practice of lawyering, certainly in the last 3 years, absolutely since Rendien was issued 27 years ago and Walker 10 years ago. We're no longer operating with the same sort of geographic boundaries in the practice of lawyering as we once were, and consequently, it makes less sense to be tying the hourly rates to the same sorts of boundaries that maybe they once were, to regular rates across county or county by county, vicinage by vicinage, or even region by region, because that's not
how. How does that play out? Let's say there's a case in Bergen County, one of the more expensive counties to litigate in. Could the court lower the rate based upon billing rates in Salem County and Cape May County and Southern Hunterdon and Warren and more rural areas where the rates may be lower?
Sure. So we are encouraging a statewide understanding of this. And so I take it that you're saying
everything should all be in the mix, even if that lowers the rate determined?
I think we would encourage a finger on the scale toward higher rates in part.
I get that. But when you say the community should be considered more broadly, we're not talking about just wishful thinking here. We're talking about data, and you might end up with a lower rate based upon data in a broader community, statewide, East Coast, some broader area.
That is very possible. And we already see that the District of New Jersey is applying a forum-wide rate. So this is not unprecedented, right? But I take your point, Justice. And also, just to draw your attention to what they do in Philadelphia, that also a lot of courts in South Jersey do, which is to look to what Community Legal Services does. They have a specific schedule. And so I'm not entirely sure how they determine that schedule. But I see your point that it is possible it could lower overall rates. However, expanding the understanding of the relevant community, right, goes toward equity issues. If, for example, there are our clients in South Jersey or Central Jersey that want to bring a claim, but they can't, pay a retainer or a significant hourly rate, and an attorney would have to take it on contingency, but they also know that there are clients in North Jersey who would be able to get them higher rates on contingency. They're more likely to flock to plaintiffs elsewhere. So it's really an equity issue in terms of ensuring people can find attorneys across the state wherever they are, or, you know, maybe attorneys in North Jersey won't be discouraged from litigating a case in a different county that has a lower rate, to ensure that people do have access to counsel and consequently are able to get into the court to vindicate their rights. So having this sort of like more geographically limited understanding disadvantages clients where there are lower rates in terms of not being able to find an attorney, but it also disadvantages attorneys doing the same good work across the state. People have the same protections across the state. It makes sense for people to be able to have the same access to attorneys. Now, statewide, we settle on statewide in part to address that geographic inequity issue, in part also because we have good precedent here in the District of New Jersey, and it's simply easier to implement. There's currently, and as you know, a lot of my of the other counsel have stated, it's difficult, right, because there's not a lot of published case law discussing what rates are, or, and this was the case as I was preparing the brief here, there's not a lot of published case law even defining what relevant community they're looking to.
What, where, is there a data set somewhere that states the rates statewide, averages them, averages selected? I mean, I understand you, what you're looking for is the plaintiff to be able to put in the plaintiff in a county where the rates are lower to be able to put in the Bergen County lawyer, but that's not necessarily accurate. If you're saying statewide, you should be getting data from the entire state.
Understood.
Selectively, I'd like to have a bigger geographic area to find the highest rate that I possibly can. See what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, and I wish I knew of data like that was collected. But again, I turn to both what the District of New Jersey do and what CLS Community Legal Services has done, and they might be good examples. I can't point to anything in particular in the state that collects that data. But I just to continue a little bit with my earlier discussion of unpublished decisions not necessarily making clear what the relevant community is, we urge this court to make the contours of that community clearer. And you know, certainly regional would be preferred over county by county, vicinage by vicinage. But to ensure that we do have consistency and that we do, we are not discouraging attorneys from taking these cases on contingency. And lastly, just to emphasize the risks in these cases and what we want to do to ensure that attorneys are not discouraged from taking on these cases on contingency, to recognize the increased time, and in this case it was a lot of time, but the increased time spent litigating a case leads to a much higher risk of non-payment. To the extent that this court discusses that sort of effect on enhancement, we would encourage the court to make sure to emphasize or recognize that increased risk of nonpayment and the role that it should play for the enhancement, especially insofar as it affects whether people are willing to take cases on contingency. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.